first visit to Perimeter, and it's certainly a very pleasant place. So what I'll be talking about today is really some work done with Alerian Melnikov about a month ago concerning, as the title suggests, moduli of heterotic string compactifications. I should also say at the beginning, it wasn't clear to me what the audience would be, who would be in the audience today, so I've tried to start with a lot of introductory material, and let me also encourage people to ask lots of questions. The flip side of that is that for at least a few people in the audience, much of this is likely to be fairly boring, but bear with me if you're one of those people, and I hope to get to something you will find more interesting relatively soon. So, heterotic strings. So for grad students in the audience, remember a heterotic string in 10 dimensions is specified by primarily a metric plus a non-abelian gauge field. So if I'm going to compactify a heterotic string, and I am, this talk is going to be about moduli, about deformations of heterotic string compactifications, I have to specify not only a space, not only a metric on the internal six dimensions, but also a non-abelian gauge field on those internal six dimensions. And that non-abelian gauge field would be encoded in some bundles. So for the rest of the talk, I'll just talk about bundles. So let X be some space. Let script E denote some bundle over that space. In broad brushstrokes, what sort of constraints have to be satisfied? Well, first and foremost, the bundle is constrained. The second churn class, the instanton number of that bundle, has to match the instanton number of the tangent bundle. This is essentially the Green-Schwarz anomaly cancellation condition in heterotic strings applied to string compactification. Now, in addition to that, there are a few other constraints. I mentioned these two in particular because they will come up again later. One of those constraints is that the bundle has to be holomorphic. Or phrased another way, when I express the curvature of this bundle in terms of a complex structure on this space, then the purely holomorphic parts and the purely anti-holomorphic parts of the curvature have to vanish. The curvature has to have one holomorphic index and one anti-holomorphic index. And then finally, there's a third condition called the Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau equation, which says that if I contract the metric into the curvature, that contraction should vanish. This is a system of PDEs. I've suppressed the Lie algebra index, so this isn't really one differential equation. This is as many differential equations as the dimension of the Lie algebra of the gauge field in question. So, mathematically, this ties into what's called stability properties of holomorphic vector bundles. Physically, in a low-energy theory, this ties into D-terms and compactifications and compactified theories. Now, often, we want X to be a Calabi-Yau manifold. At least that yields the simplest sort of heterotic string compactifications. So I want X to be complex and Kähler and have a nowhere zero holomorphic top form. Now, in this case, we often, for historical reasons, divide possible bundles into essentially two classes, corresponding to the amount of supersymmetry on the world sheet. The simplest case, the oldest case, if you will, is the case of 2-2 world sheet supersymmetry. In this case, the gauge bundle is the same as the tangent bundle. The non-abelian gauge field is the same as the spin connection. We refer to this as the standard embedding because it was, well, standard for a long time. And then the more general case of 0-2 supersymmetry has a holomorphic vector bundle satisfying the conditions on the previous transparency, but that bundle does not have to be the same as the tangent bundle, does not even have to be deformable to the tangent bundle. Now, those are Calabi-Yau compactifications. Other, absolutely.
Why would it even be possible for the bundle to be equal to tangent space? Wouldn't you have a different dimension gauge group or something?
Oh, like it's a fair question. I'm starting in 10 dimensions with either an E8 cross E8 or spin 32 mod Z2 gauge symmetry. What I'm going to do though is only, I'll only work with some, the non-trivial part of that, the non-trivial part of the non-abelian gauge field won't typically be all of the E8 cross E8 or spin 32 mod Z2. It will only be some subgroup, some subalgebra inside there. So for example, if I'm compactifying from 10 dimensions to 4 dimensions, so I've rolled up on some internal 6-dimensional space or some 3-complex-dimensional space, then the tangent bundle to that space will have, well, if it's a Calabi-Yau, an SU3 structure group, or I could think of it as giving rise to an SU3 non-abelian gauge field. So in that case, in the case of the standard embedding, what I would then do is embed that SU3 inside the E8 cross E8 or spin 32 mod Z2. So that larger gauge symmetry would have this smaller non-trivial SU3 embedded inside it. And then the effect of that would be that in the low energy four-dimensional theory, you get a gauge symmetry that was essentially just the subgroup that commutes with the non-trivial part. So for the case of E8 cross E8, say, let's embed the SU3 inside one of the E8s. The other E8 passes down to the low energy theory, no problem, because it wasn't interfered with at all. Now in the group theory of E8, the maximal rank, the pertinent subgroup of E8 that for this question is an E6 cross SU3 mod Z3. And if you ask for the subgroup of E8 that then commutes with that non-trivial SU3 you embedded, if you embed it into that SU3 I implicitly referred to a minute ago, then the resulting low energy gauge group is an E6. That's what commutes with the SU3 you embedded inside that E8. And then for spin 32, it's gonna be, a spin 26 cross U1, you get it after playing the same game. But that's basically how this works. So that's how I can have a bundle of, the rank of the bundle is not determined by the, not uniquely determined by the size of the 10-dimensional non-abelian gauge group I start with. So that's how I can have the bundle be the tangent bundle. The bundle can also be different from the tangent bundle. I could have other rank holomorphic bundles. I can embed a rank 4 bundle or rank 5 bundle, give rise to a low energy SO10, SU5, and so forth and so on. Does that answer the question? Okay. Right, so Clabial compactifications. So Clabial compactifications are the simplest ones, the easiest ones, the sort of the most fun ones. They're the toy models for the real world. Other times, we want X to be non-Kähler. So non-Kähler compactifications are, in principle, one suspects, somewhat more generic. They have various properties we suspect would be pertinent. We believe in gross broad brushstrokes that non-Kähler spaces probably have fewer moduli than Clabials. So one of the usual problems in string compactification is if you compactify in something like a Clabial, you get a lot of extra singlet neutral moduli fields, some real scalars decoupled from the gauge group, which are completely unphysical. One of the broad hopes of people working on non-Kähler spaces is that one might be able to eliminate a lot of those by working with a non-Kähler space. So here, if the internal space is non-Kähler, we'll still want it to have a complex structure and a nowhere zero holomorphic top form for reasons written about a quarter century ago. In this case, there is also a non-zero background three-form field strength, a sort of an analog of a background electric field, which is determined by the metric. If omega is a differential form built from the Hermitian metric on the space, then this three form is built from derivatives of omega. It vanishes if the space is Kähler. It's non-zero precisely when the metric is non-Kähler. All right, so far I've just reviewed various possible heterotic compactifications. Now in this talk, what I really want to do is talk about the moduli, the allowed deformations of these compactifications. Now, broadly speaking, in broad brushstrokes, the moduli come, roughly speaking, in two classes, moduli of the metric and moduli of the non-abelian gauge field, moduli of the bundle. However, because of conditions like the fact that the bundle has to be holomorphic, these can be intertwined, and to an extent that people have only really started to understand within about the last year, as a matter of fact. So in particular, in Clabial compactifications, historically, for the last quarter century, everyone's just assumed that the moduli were exactly the moduli of the metric plus the moduli of the bundle, and truthfully, the significance of those conditions, that the bundle be holomorphic, has not really been understood. About a year ago, some people, primarily a group at Penn, pointed out that even for Clabial compactifications, the story is a bit more complicated, and part of what I'll be discussing today are their results. In non-Kähler heterotic compactifications, people basically haven't had a clue. There's essentially only one thing people know about non-Kähler heterotic compactifications, and that's that a certain breathing mode, which rescales the entire metric, should be absent. It's present for Clabials, it shouldn't be present in non-Kähler spaces, and nothing else is known, for reasons I'll outline later. So what I'm going to do today is to present an expression, a proposal, say, for the moduli of heterotic Kähler and non-Kähler compactifications, which among other things will give a worldsheet understanding of this updated story I alluded to. So, here's an outline of the rest of the talk. I'm going to spend a few minutes speaking in general terms about moduli of metrics, moduli of bundles, what people have known, and in particular, what people have worked out within the last year. Then after I'm done describing the what's known about moduli, I'll present the proposal. I'll describe our proposal for infinitesimal moduli. I'll give an expression as co-cycles and co-boundaries. And then after I presented the result and performed some consistency checks, then at the end, I'll go back and explain where in the devil it comes from. So, moduli. As I mentioned earlier, generally speaking, there are two sources of moduli in heterotic compactifications. Moduli of the metric on the internal space, moduli of the non-abelian gauge field on the internal space, required to obey conditions of this form. Let's begin with metric moduli. On Calabi-Yau manifolds, there's a math theorem that says the metric moduli break up into deformations of the complex structure and deformations of what's called the Kähler structure, essentially deformations, sort of orthogonal deformations of the metric. The complex structure deformations we can understand schematically in this line here. If I start with an almost complex structure on some space, perturbed by some amount, demand that the nine-Heuss tensor then vanish, what I'll get is a PDE which boils down to saying that that deformation has to be annihilated by the anti-holomorphic derivative. Similarly for Kähler structure, if I start with a form built from the metric, a 1 comma 1 form, the same sort of omega as I had a couple transparencies ago, and imagine deforming that by some amount delta omega, and then demand that the resulting structure still be Kähler, what I get is a PDE that says that this deformation has to be annihilated by d bar. Mathematically, this condition gets interpreted as a statement that these complex structure deformations are counted by this particular group here. This statement is interpreted mathematically as a statement that these Kähler structure deformations are counted by this particular mathematical group. Now, on non-Kähler manifolds, part of the reason for the confusion I alluded to earlier is that there's no known analog of Yau's theorem. So on Calabi-Yau's, we can apply Yau's theorem to say that the moduli of the metric have to break up into complex and Kähler structures, and that's worked very well for us. On non-Kähler manifolds, there's no known analog of Yau's theorem. So we, in principle, don't have a clue how to describe these things.
Then Yau's theorem says that those were the most general deformations?
Or that those are all of them. Or in fact, or bundle. In fact, there's the more precise statement of Yau's theorem, which I'm sure Philip can point out if I get it wrong, is that a Calabi-Yau metric is uniquely determined by a complex structure and, well, a complex structure and a Kähler structure. And that's not quite the most precise statement, but that's, I think, good enough for the time being. So the moduli of a Calabi-Yau are precisely in one-to-one correspondence with complex structure moduli and Kähler moduli. All right.
You said it was wrong in some sense that you're going to explain.
No, I'm not talking about the bundle moduli.
Right. Where the complication ensues is when you add bundle moduli to the mix. And then since the mid-80s, since these compactifications were first worked out, people have assumed that the moduli of a heterotic compactification, even a heterotic Calabi-Yau compactification, would just be the sum of the metric moduli and the bundle moduli. And then about a year ago, someone pointed out that, actually, the conditions the bundle be holomorphic actually obstruct some of those moduli. So even for Calabi-Yau, the correct number of moduli isn't just the sum of metric and bundle. It's some more complicated arrangement I'll come to in a few minutes.
So the Yau's theorem was ignoring the bundle?
That's right. Yau's theorem is only for the metric. I don't know of a precise analog of Yau's theorem for metrics plus bundles. I'm not even certain how to formulate a conjecture. But Yau's theorem is just about metrics. It doesn't involve bundles at all. So bundle moduli. So far, I've just talked about metric moduli. For bundle moduli, there's an analogous story. If I start with a non-abelian gauge field, I could deform it. If I demand this sort of condition for both the original gauge field and the deformation, then the deformation has to be annihilated by d bar. We interpret that mathematically as saying that that deformation has to lie inside this particular mathematical group. Now, so far I've described these separately, and one of the first points is that going to be that because of these conditions, the metric and bundle moduli mix. Now, when are they going to mix? For 2-2 Calabi-Yau compactifications, for the Calabi-Yau compactifications with the standard embedding, there's no mixing. More general 0-2 Calabi-Yau cases will mix. This was first observed about a year ago by Laura Anderson, James Gray, Andre Lucas, and Bert Overit. And we'll see the details of this as I proceed. So the next little thing. I'm still giving an overview of moduli. Once I'm done giving an overview of moduli, then I'll present the proposal. And then after I present the proposal, then at the end, I'll go back and derive the proposal. So I'm in the middle of describing moduli at the moment. So the next thing to do is to sort of more systematically describe these three cases. So first off, 2-2 supersymmetry, standard embedding Calabi-Yau. As I've said before, the allowed moduli are metric moduli, complex and Kähler, and bundle moduli, and a set notation I will be using later. I will denote complex structure moduli with a Z, Kähler moduli with a Y, and bundle moduli with a lambda. And in the 2-2 case, the point is that the Zs, the Ys, and the lambdas are all three annihilated by D bar. Now, and for completeness, let me also describe this in terms of what I'm calling co-cycles and co-boundaries. If I write out the fact that these are annihilated by D-bar and components, that's what it means. I'm allowed to mod out by these equivalences. Now, 0-2 supersymmetry. Here's where things start to get a little bit more exciting. And again, it was thought for a long time that in 0-2 Calabi-Yau compactifications, the full set of moduli is the sum, complex, Kähler, plus bundle. And in fact, there's a mixing ultimately due to this fact. The point is that this constrains the bundle to be holomorphic, but what I mean for a bundle to be holomorphic is determined by the complex structure on the base space. So in particular, it is possible to build examples of a holomorphic bundle on a Calabi-Yau such that I cannot deform both the bundle moduli and the complex structure moduli. Some bundle deformations might require certain complex structures, might not be compatible with some of the complex structures. Or put another way, if I try to deform the complex structures in certain directions, I might break the holomorphic structure on the bundle. Usually, sort of in the easy cases, if I deform the complex structure on the base space, I can drag along the complex structure on the bundle so that it remains holomorphic and we can ignore the sort of mixing issue. But sometimes it can happen that if I deform the complex structure on the base, then the complex structure on the bundle breaks. There won't be a way to deform the complex structure on the bundle in line with what's going on in the base space. And that's really the point of this. So the correct replacement is a gadget that's a bit more complicated. This is some relatively old and in certain circles well-known mathematics. Instead of computing the sum of bundle and complex structure moduli, what you really want to do is compute cohomology of this thing I'm calling Q, which mathematically is a bundle built as an extension of the tangent bundle by the endomorphisms of the gauge bundle. This possible extensions are determined by the curvature. Well, the pertinent extension is determined by the curvature of this guy. It turns out that the curvature class, the cohomology class of the curvature of the bundle, has exactly the right properties to determine such an extension. And cohomology of that is the correct replacement, encodes the possible obstructions to deforming the complex structure, something that was noticed by Atiyah probably back when he was in high school.
And what is
pi? This pi? Oh, this is just the notation for the map projecting from here to here because this map is determined in terms of it, so I had to give this a name.
What is E star?
Oh, it's the dual bundle. So I'm taking the dual of this tensor vector bundle and tensoring it into the original bundle. This is the endomorphism bundle of the gauge bundle in question, modulo some factor of O, which I'm glossing over.
You mean the tensor product?
It's the tensor product of E and E star. Is the
thing is the endomorphism.
Yeah, I guess I really ought to quotient by some trivial factor inside there. But yeah, that's basically the endomorphism bundle of E and E star. All right, so once you have this sort of extension, there are some math tricks you can play. You get a sequence of cohomology groups like this. Here is the gadget that is claimed to encode the correct replacement for complex and bundle moduli. These are the bundle moduli. These are the complex structure moduli. The bundle moduli all map one-to-one into this thing. this thing projects onto some of the complex structure moduli. However, not all of the complex structure moduli might actually be in the image of this, and not all the complex structure moduli might be living in there. In particular, any complex structure moduli that interact with F, such that if I take this map and act on them and get something non-zero, any of those complex structure moduli will be removed. And again, the physical interpretation is that those complex structure moduli are ones for which the bundle will stop being holomorphic if I push in that direction.
But why did it stop? It shouldn't stop, right? It goes further.
Oh, that's right. It goes further, but I just got tired of writing down terms.
Care.
These are the. That's right. I don't care. These are the only ones that are pertinent for this discussion. All right. There are some examples of this discussed in Anderson, Gray, Lucas, and Overt from about a year ago. I've outlined schematically what the form of their examples. I start with some hypersurface and a product of projective spaces. They cook up an example of a stable, indecomposable rank 2 bundle that exists only on some subset of the complex structure moduli space. And they point out that if you try deforming the complex structure on some direction that's perpendicular to that sublocus, then you will break the complex structure on that bundle. And for this talk, that's sufficient. Let me also mention there's a.
These things rule out potential moduli of the bundle or of the base space?
The base space. These are lifting potential complex structure moduli. All of the bundle moduli are still present in these cases. So there's an analog of this for D-brains, which I'm well acquainted with, and just for fun wanted to point out. If I wrap a D-brain on some complex submanifold, the Chan-Peyton factors are again described by some bundle and at least under certain circumstances required to be holomorphic. Then naively, one has two sets of moduli for the D-brain corresponding to deformations of the Chan-Peyton factor or deformations of the bundle and motions of the D-brain inside whatever space that D-brain is sitting in. However, in general, some motions of that submanifold can destroy the holomorphic structure on the bundle. So in general, there's a constraint on the possible brain motions. So you can build examples of this. The easiest example is if you have a K3 fibered Calabi-Yau threefold. If you wrap a D-brain on a P1 that's rigid inside a K3 fiber, if you move the K3 fiber, that P1 disappears, or at least it stops being holomorphic, and then your D-brain has, if you wrap your D-brain on the K3 and then put a line bundle on it, where the line bundle is determined by a divisor, which is that rigid little P1, if you move the K3 in the fibration, that little P1 vanishes, so your line bundle stops being holomorphic. So in any event, there is an analogous story there. The correct moduli are described by some group containing all of these and a subset of these, and there's a fancy name for that group. It's this group down here, but that will play no further role in this talk. Let me describe this phenomenon in Calabi-Yau compactifications more explicitly in terms of cocycles and coboundaries. Previously, I wrote down local coordinate expressions for z's, y's, and lambdas. And yeah.
So for the D-brain picture, is there like a dynamical picture that you can have or something like that? Or?
It's just the computation here is easiest done in the B-model topological field theory. It's not even dynamical. It's just a statement about the. Moduli. Or phrase. Let me take another stab at it. Maybe I'm not quite understanding your question. You might ask, is the issue here that the moduli are obstructed by something like a potential term, or that they're not even present? The answer is they're not even present. It's not that they're obstructed. It's not that there's some potential term that lifts those. It's that they're not even present in the BRST cohomology on the world sheet. And in fact, there's something similar going on in this, in these heterotic Calabi-Yau compactifications. And one of the reasons I got into this project was try to straighten out for myself, was this lifting that Laura and James and Bert and Andre were describing, was it because there was a potential term that was obstructing some of the complex structure moduli, or was it because on the world sheet in BRST cohomology, those directions were actually lifted? And the answer is the latter. Those directions are actually lifted in BRST cohomology. There's not a potential because there's not even any massless scalars to lift. All right, so in local coordinates, previously, in the 2-2 case, I had three lines like this, except the right-hand sides were all zero. I said that d bar of z vanished, d bar of y vanished, just like here. And then in addition, previously I said that d bar of lambda vanished, which is no longer the case. This equation comes right out of one of Lahr and Company's papers. It's equation 3.8 in their most recent paper on this subject. Similarly, one also gets to mod out coboundaries, and the modification of the coboundaries is this last term here. Now, how does this affect the moduli in this more explicit language? Well, again, the Z is the complex structure moduli. The right-hand side up here is the image of this map in this sequence. Furthermore, in this D-bar cohomology, the left-hand side is trivial. So for this whole thing to admit solutions, this right-hand side also has to be trivial in cohomology. Otherwise, the equation doesn't make sense. And that's essentially the origin of the problem. Only if this right-hand side is cohomologically trivial, only for certain Zs, can this equation admit a solution. That's equivalent to the statement that only when the image of a complex structure modulus in this group is zero, can it hope to come from an element of this group. All right, some other checks. Now, 0,2 generalizes 2,2 in the sense that if I deform, if I have a deformation of the tangent bundle, I should be able to deform back to the 2,2 story just by deforming the deformation back to starting point. Here, that's not obvious. Here, I have this more complicated equation. D bar of lambda is this contraction involving f. Now, on the 2,2 locus, these f's aren't zero. These become the Riemann curvature tensors for the underlying space. So I need to explain how in the world this becomes equivalent to this. And let me do that next. So briefly, on the 2,2 locus, again, f becomes the Riemann curvature tensor, and one can redefine the lambdas. Here's the cocycle condition when f becomes the Riemann curvature tensor. The terms on the right are problematic. We'd like to get rid of them. To do that, we just translate lambda. We define a lambda twiddle to be a lambda minus some covariant derivative of z. And then if we do a bit of algebra, we find that d bar of lambda twiddle is, well, it's this mess, but with just a couple of lines of algebra, this becomes the same as this. So this difference of lambdas is from this equation up here, a difference of Riemann curvature tensors contracted into z's. Then this mess becomes a pair of commutators of covariant derivatives and commutators of d bar of z. Now d bar of z still vanishes, and furthermore, this difference of commutators cancels out this difference of Riemann curvature tensors on z. So altogether, it's just about off the screen, this difference of derivatives of lambda twiddles vanishes. So that's how this can reduce correctly on the 2,2 locus. You can do something analogous for coboundaries. Again, I shifted lambdas to lambda twiddles by subtracting off a covariant derivative of z's. If I think about the coboundaries, here were the coboundaries I had previously. Here are the coboundaries for the z's. So lambda twiddles now have these more complicated coboundaries. Basically, the story is that this cancels out this. So specifically, these guys are the problem. Let me define a little lambda twiddle to be a translate of the original little lambda. Then,
Are always the right definition of the right moduli? I mean, that you should use this redefinition even in the 2,2 locus.
You could. Yeah, we played various algebraic games with rewriting those cocycle conditions. The form we came up with, well, the form, one could. One can play various algebraic games with rewriting cocycle conditions. The ones you're seeing here are just the most reasonable looking things we came up with. But yeah, one can play those games. So anyway, one makes a sort of redefinition. The lambda twiddles now have this coboundary form, but then these last two terms, making this redefinition was needed in order to turn that product of covariant derivatives into a commutator. That vanishes, and so we're done. We can absorb these annoying Riemann curvature terms on the 2,2 locus into some redefinitions. And so we recover the standard cocycle coboundary description on the 2,2 locus. All right, moduli. I'm still reviewing moduli. I have not yet gotten to the actual new part of the talk, That's coming up soon. So all that remains is to talk about. You get anything just before going on to the non-cursed?
Do you get anything extra when you post on a
snowboard cap? You can. That imposes constraints too. I don't have a co-cycle type description for the form of that. Typically what it does, there are some interesting things that happened when you opposed Donaldson Ulenbeck-Yale. Ask me about it later, because I'm happy to explain it in detail. It's just, it's a bit too far afield to summarize nicely here.
I guess the thing in the back of my mind was, with half an eye on any attempt at mirror symmetry, mm-hmm. you seem to have changed the complex structure moduli and not touched the Kähler moduli.
Complex structure moduli. Well, this is also, that's a nice point. Remember, this is also in the 0-2 supersymmetric theory. So ordinary mirror symmetry is only defined for 2-2 supersymmetric theories. For 0-2 supersymmetric theories, there is believed to be an analog of mirror symmetry, but it's probably safe to say we don't have a completely concrete understanding of it yet. So this will be very important for the development of 0-2 mirror symmetry, but that's still, it's still somewhat in its infancy. And indeed, it will be the case that when we properly understand 0-2 mirror symmetry one of these days, this will certainly play a crucial role. This story, as well as Donaldson-Ulenbeck-Yale.
At the moment, the story is nothing changes the sort of naive Kähler moduli.
That's right, because on the two, that's right. And even on the 2-2 locus, nothing changes the complex structure moduli. On the 2-2 locus, all the moduli as before, ordinary mirror symmetry is unaffected. And on the 0-2 locus, this will eventually play an important role for 0-2 mirror symmetry. We just don't know enough about 0-2 mirror symmetry to really say all that much.
Why didn't you say it that way? On the 2-2 locus?
Uh-huh.
Are you thinking of that as embedded in some big space?
Or? That's right. Because typically, I can take the tangent bundle and deform it to a different bundle. So I keep the space the same, but I deform the tangent bundle to something else. I can't always do it, but typically I can. So in that, from that perspective, I can indeed think about the case where the Gauge bundle is a tangent bundle as just being some little sliver inside some larger space where I've deformed the, I have a more general bundle. All right.
So is that larger space of interest? Is there something?
Oh yeah. It's very much of interest for, well, for example, 0-2 mirror symmetry.
It's 0-2 is another special, very special.
No, 0-2 is.
What? It's a special case of 0-2.
2-2 is a special case of 0-2. I see. Interesting.
Right. It's the 2-2, 0-2 is counting the amount of supersymmetry on the world sheet. So as you go from special situations to general situations, the amount of supersymmetry reduces. So 2-2, where you have more supersymmetry, is a special case. And then 0-2, when you go to a more generic situation, is the general case. Yeah?
So physically, 2-2, you said we can think of it as the standard embedding?
Yeah.
And, and the 0-2 would be the more generalized.
More general hydrodynamic compact location.
Sometimes you can't really deform.
Well, that's absolutely right. For example, I could start with a 0-2 compactification in which the bundle is not a deformation of the tangent bundle. That's, you know, probably most 0-2 compactifications have that property. For example, if I compactify to 4 dimensions on some Calabi-Yau threefold, then the rank of the bundle on the 2-2 locus is 3, whereas I could start with a rank 4 or rank 5 bundle or whatnot. If I start with a rank 4 or 5 bundle, then I can't, I can't really smoothly deform in a mathematical sense back to a rank 3 bundle. Well, there are some tricks you can play, but you start running into issues with stability with Donaldson-Ulenbeck-Yale for the obvious things. So typically, one cannot deform a generic 0-2 bundle back to the tangent bundle, but sometimes you can.
And then these examples that Lucas et al. Discovered, is it possible to do a deformation to?
I don't know. No, not in their examples. So in particular, they had examples of Calabi-Yau threefolds and rank 2 bundles. And so there'd be no way, unless something very special is going on I'm not seeing, there'd be no way of deforming those rank 2 bundles back to the tangent bundle. All right.
Is there some interest in going beyond 0-2? I mean, is that also a locus in some?
In that spirit, let me go on to this. So here, talking about 2-2 or 0-2 is a little bit complicated and a non-Kähler hydrolytic compactification. So I'll, one of the issues in a non-Kähler compactification is that a world sheet theory, speaking of world sheet theory at all, is perhaps not the most sensible thing to do. So whether it's really fair to say that this is some more general setup and 0-2 is a special case, that's probably not an entirely fair description, but I couldn't help myself from seizing the moment to imply that. There are more general things. Let me do that for this talk. I'll just do 2-2, 0-2, and then non-Kähler stuff, and I'd be happy to chat later about more general things still that also exist and one can do. So, non-Kähler compactifications. Previously, I've talked about Klabiel compactifications where we had bundle moduli, complex or metric moduli, and mixings between them. Here, basically, we don't know anything. Well, there's one thing that everyone agrees on, which is that in a Klabiel compactification, there's a simple Kähler modulus in which you just rescale the metric of the entire Klabiel by a single constant factor, a sort of breathing mode or radial rescaling mode. In non-Kähler compactifications, that's generally believed to be absent. So the reason is that, well, alpha primer and H are quantized. There are a couple of different arguments for this floating around the literature. Both have their merits, both achieve the same goals, and they both work in somewhat orthogonal domains. If you write down the Green-Schwarz anomaly cancellation condition, you end up with a nonlinear equation alpha prime. So alpha primes, values of alpha prime are somewhat isolated. At tree level, H is quantized, but H is proportional to derivatives of the metric. So if I rescale the metric continuously, I would rescale H continuously, which would violate this problem here. Because that breathing mode is absent, one cannot smoothly deform a non-Kähler compactification to a weak coupling limit where a world sheet description is wholly accurate. So, furthermore, relations to geometry usually take place in such weak coupling or large radius, large breathing mode limits. So whenever I talk about non-Kähler compactifications, whenever anyone talks about non-Kähler compactifications and geometry in the same breath, you should take everything that's said with a grain of salt, this talk included. But to the extent one can hope to approximate facts about the physics of non-Kähler compactifications with geometry, and whether or not that's reasonable or not. Well, it's... That's right, and no one really knows, which is part of the issue. So we can... That's right.
Precise thing, but it's not like outright wrong.
If that's right, and I would argue that's reasonable so long as you're working with an H in which the metric is fixed to be largish,
yes.
Say. Right, and then there are issues of, well, you have to start with guys in that form. We have to do some sort of perturbation expansion. Right, exactly. That's why Klabiels are so much fun. Well, it's in the usual Klabiel case, indeed. We do a perturbation expansion around large radius. Here also, assuming that we're fixed sufficiently close to large radius, we could do a perturbation expansion as well. Part of the problem is we don't really know how close to large radius we can get. I'm also reminded of the cautionary example of WW models, where you have, in effect, another compactification with a quantized H flux, and therefore, most values of H, most values of the level. The geometry of the group manifold really isn't a good guide to the physics of the WW model. So, I'm just saying there's a potential issue here, which I can't really deal with. All right.
That seems to be a key point which I didn't understand at all.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that there's sort of a string can't live in this?
Or
what exactly does it mean to say you can't mix geometry?
We believe a string can live in this. However, we also believe that there are various quantum corrections to the theory which we cannot completely turn off. And when there are such quantum corrections, oftentimes such quantum corrections will complicate or obscure physical computations. So the game in Calabi-Yau cases, the game in much of the string compactifications community, is to take physics questions about a string compactification, number of massless fields, number of massless charged fields, possible couplings between those fields, and turn them into purely mathematical questions about the internal space. So that's a fun game to play. If you can work out that dictionary, then you can go to your math friends and say, okay guys, how do I compute, you know, this math thing, because that's telling me the number of massless fields of this and such, or the couplings between certain fields. The danger in cases like this is that although one can formulate such a dictionary, there exist quantum corrections one cannot turn off, which will modify the answers. So I can set up a dictionary which says, okay, the number of massless, watch this slide. In principle, I can imagine setting up a dictionary which says the number of massless fields should be this math group. And I can go to some mathematicians and have them compute it, but the answer might not be well connected to the physics because my dictionary will be corrected by quantum corrections over which I may not have much control.
Which corrections are you talking about?
Alpha prime corrections.
So they're kind of pushing the limit of this being small.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, all that said, there are a few special cases where people know something. And Alan Adams and Josh LaPon, for example, have some nice work on analogs of gauge linear signal models for such non-Kähler compactifications.
Just one follow-up on that.
Okay.
So, from that point of view, you seem to be unhappy that you don't have this breathing world. But from a physics point of view, that would seem to be a good thing.
That's right. Because it eliminates a massless scalar, massless uncharged scalar from the field, from the theory. I agree completely. This is one of the fundamental tensions in work on string compactifications. On the one hand, we like to turn everything about string compactifications into math questions, but on the other hand, our ability to turn everything into math questions is due in no small part to the fact that there exists a massless scalar in those particular theories. If we eliminate the massless scalar, which brings us closer to physics, we have less control over the dictionary between math and physics becomes a bit more problematic. So there is this fundamental tension in the subject. No one has yet come up with a really efficient workaround for that tension. All right, so far I've outlined moduli. I have not yet described the result. Let me do that next. Here's the proposal. It looks much like what's appeared so far. I have z's, y's, and lambdas. The z's still are annihilated by d bar. The lambdas, d bar of the lambdas, still involves f contracted into z's. And then we get this extra piece. When I take d bar of y's, I get z's contracted into h's, where h is that three form determined by the metric. And then we have co-boundaries. Z's are related to z's, or we identify z's if they're related by this stuff, we identify lambdas if they're related by this stuff, we identify y's if they're related by this stuff, and this is the essential new term here. So this is the new bit, these terms involving h's. Now let me give a few consistency checks. For Calabi-Yau compactifications, h is zero, at least at tree level, so those three equations just reduce to what we had before. So that's good. Second check, breathing mode. For heterotic non-Kähler compactifications, where h is not zero, the only thing we think we know is the breathing mode should be absent. Well, in this equation here, for the y's, if I set z to zero, if I don't allow myself to simultaneously deform the complex structure, and take y to be proportional to the metric, which would ordinarily be appropriate for the breathing mode that just does the overall rescaling of the metric, then since the metric is non-Kähler, d bar of y is non-zero, and so this breathing mode has to be lifted. Now, how can we interpret this mathematically? If I want to actually compute cocycles mod co-boundaries, the game I usually play is to recognize that it's some sort of mathematics computation, do the mathematics computation, and then, you know, work with the result.
Why didn't you just prove that the breathing mode was lifted? Why is it just... Why wasn't that thing you just said as a proof that the breathing mode is lifted?
It is, but then the trick here is that I'm giving a proposal for the moduli.
No, that, I understand. What is the right homology that we discover?
So it's a consistency check.
But you were sort of implying that it's thought that the breathing mode is not there.
Oh,
we don't know for sure whether it's there or something.
I meant to say that it's. Well, I'm being. So perhaps I misspoke. I should have just said.
The conjectural part is that those equations might not be.
That's right. That's right. This is the proposal. So this I've pulled out of thin air. I haven't told you guys where this comes from. I'll get to the derivation at the end because it, to my mind, is sort of the least interesting part of all of this. But this is the proposal, and I'm just performing.
If that proposal is right, then there is no breathing.
That's right. And that's what we expect to be the case. So it's a consistency check. Right. So for Clabiales, everything works. We can match the only thing we know about non-Kähler cases. Let me try to give some sort of math interpretation of this. Let me concentrate on what looks like the pure metric part, the z's and the y's. And let me work at tree level. Let me set alpha prime to 0, which means h is going to be a closed 3 form. Now, in that case, since h is a closed 3 form, if you work through the description of h earlier, that means that the 2, 1 part of h is annihilated by d bar, which means it defines.
Can't you show that if dh is 0, then h is 0?
Depends upon the cohomology of the space. You're probably thinking of Clabiales, So for example, if I have a T2 bundle, I assume the argument you have in the back of your mind is just if I know which part of the parts of the cohomology vanishes, then if dH equals 0, there's no way that there could be a closed form. But what's going on here, but in general, for spaces in which that appear in non-Kähler compactifications, it's possible to have closed 3 forms. I assume that's what you're, even on Clabiales actually, but.
I thought, I thought there was some elementary manipulation you can perform. You know, one of these things, you multiply things together and integrate by parts, and you can show that if dH is 0, then h is 0.
It's, to the best of my knowledge, in non-Kähler cases, that doesn't have to be true. But, one learns something new every day. Why don't we get together with Senya tomorrow?
Yeah, sure,
And I'd be happy to be proven wrong, but I think when alpha prime 0, formally, to the extent that makes sense, h can be non-zero. All right, so if you'll let me proceed at least formally, and then tomorrow we can discuss details. The 2-1 part of h defines a cohomology class, which turns out to be just right to define an extension like this, of the cotangent bundle by the tangent bundle. So the metric moduli would then be elements of the cohomology of this particular extension. When h is 0, in that special case, this extension is trivial. Q is the sum of the cotangent bundle of the tangent bundle, and then the cohomology of Q becomes the sum of, well, the cohomology of the cotangent bundle and the cohomology of the tangent bundle, which exactly reproduces the standard Clabiales result. And then more generally, you get a more complicated answer. Similarly, for the full heterotic moduli, we had that set of 3 equations, one involving lambdas as well. The sum of the curvature of the bundle and h formally determines an extension of the tangent bundle by the sum of these 2 bundles, and then the full set of heterotic moduli would be elements of this particular group. Now, this math interpretation, I must confess, just occurred to me on the flight up here, so I haven't spent that much time playing with it yet. So, for example, examples of computations are in progress. The interpretation for non-zero alpha prime, the interpretation I just gave, relied on h being closed. For non-zero alpha prime, Green-Schwarz anomaly cancellation gives you a non-closed h, and in such a case, the math interpretation I gave completely breaks down. I would dearly love to derive this directly from the study of metrics on the target space. I will eventually, in the time remaining, outline a derivation on the worldsheet theory. I'd love to have a target space derivation. We desire it, we don't have it.
Excuse me, small question. Why did we just and the morphism of E. In principle, I could imagine also start from extension, studying something TxRx and then E, having some Q-tilde and then extending by Tx.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, in general, one could imagine first extending one of these guys by the other guy and then forming some extension of this by this, or maybe even something more complicated in general.
So why didn't you
it's
do that?
It's because of the structure of these equations. Let me go back a few slides here. Basically because we only have z's on this side. We have y's determined by related to z's like here, lambda's related to f's like here. Let's talk about this a bit more later.
That's the like you first wrote that, then you explained, but you could have started here with modified right side, right? But you didn't, so you probably have some reason, no?
I could have started here and modified. Oh, I haven't given a derivation of this. I haven't even tried to explain where these guys come from, and that might be the question you're asking.
No, what I am asking is really, you said that complex structure and bundle modular are entangled.
Mm-hmm.
I would naively think that also Keller modular and bundle modular are entangled because of
Simpson-Yulbecki-Yau. Yes,
and
yes
so
indeed.
My first step would be first to mix them and then mix complex structure.
Mm-hmm.
But you somehow don't mix.
It comes out of the derivation I have not yet presented.
You have a derivation for that this is true.
Which I have not yet presented.
Okay.
And the result of that derivation is that these disentangle.
Okay.
However,
And you took into account Donaldson equation.
Implicitly in the structure and the fact that what's being discussed in that derivation are properties of a conformal field theory.
Okay.
Donaldson-Yulbecki-Yau appears as it appears in the alpha prime correction to the beta function and the world shape backification. So if you actually RG flow down to a 0-2 superconformal field theory, then Donaldson-Yulbecki-Yau is implicitly taken into account. If you have a bundle that doesn't satisfy it, then you're some finite distance away from a superconformal fixed point, and you have to flow back down, and then in that flow, well, we can discuss what happens in that flow. But it's implicit in the fact that ultimately I'm manipulating superconformal field theories. The flip side of that is that since I'm manipulating superconformal field theories, talking about non-zero H may not be entirely fair. So there's a caveat in the derivation which I have not yet gotten
what
to.
What do you mean by safety, you said?
Well, let me get to it, and then we'll.
Sorry, one question.
That's all right.
Before, when we were just looking at the on the Calabi app, away from two locus, that extension just told you that some of the complex structure moduli were not really.
That's right.
So naively, I would have said that now, since you've just,
That's
how come you didn't have to be doing
that? Excellent question. I'm glad you asked that. Is there a blackboard? There's a blackboard. There's even some chalk. If you'll let me try to scribble this over here. Right, so in the second case, let me work at tree level one alpha prime. I have an extension. Let me try explaining from this direction. So here's the extension which I claim gives the metric moduli, at least at tree level one alpha prime. From this, we get a long exact sequence, which includes Tx goes to H1 T star x, this is going to be obstructed by that screen in a minute or two. Let me keep writing down, but I mean to be writing across. That goes into h1q, goes into h1tx, goes into h2t star x. Thank you. Well, I don't really need that much blackboard space. So the trick is, in the Calabi-Yau case, the tangent bundle is a stable bundle. And because it's a stable bundle, this guy is always equal to zero. So if I, now let me go back, since the screen has been helpfully removed, let me go back and write the analog for the complex and bundle mixing for Calabi-Yau. There we had an extension that goes like this. And here also we have an associated long exact sequence with the same sorts of terms. There's an H naught Tx goes to H1, goes to the bundle moduli, goes to H1q, goes to the complex structure moduli, goes to H2 E star E, and then it continues off in either direction, but I'm just omitting the other terms because they're irrelevant. In the Calabi-Yau case, the tangent bundle is stable. So one fast way to see that is actually from Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau. Remember, Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau says Gij bar Fij bar is equal to zero. In the 2-2 case, then, well, for the tangent bundle, if I apply this to the tangent bundle, this becomes, well, the Riemann tensor, including the suppressed indices. So I have Gij bar R ij bar, let me just write dot dot for the suppressed indices. But this is exactly the Riemann tensor, the Ricci tensor. So stability of the tangent bundle is, according to Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau, equivalent to the statement that the Ricci tensor vanishes. So for Clavier, the tangent bundle is always stable, which means this group is equal to zero on a Clavier. Because this group is equal to zero, the bundle deformations inject into here. So there's a one-to-one map between bundle deformations and some subset of the allowed deformations. For the non-Kähler case, the tangent bundle is no longer stable. This can be non-zero, and so these guys can obstruct mapping Kähler deformations into this group. So it's a wonderful question. I wasn't going to work through it because I thought it'd be a shade too technical, but I'm glad you asked it, because it's a fun little point. Other questions? All right, let me lower the screen and get back to the rest. All right, so I've got about 5 or 10 minutes left. Let's see if I can squeeze in the derivation once I can get through the rest of these. All right, since I'm running a bit short on time, let me run a few, run quickly through a few of these other slides. There's a quick argument for why one usually misses all of these features, both the work of Laura and James and Bert and Andre, as well as this other stuff. Intuitively, we can understand these corrections to these cocycle conditions in terms of perturbative corrections to operator products arising from 4 Fermi terms in the world sheet theory, and also from analogous terms involving a 3-form H flux in the world sheet theory. Again, I'm formally manipulating the world sheet theory, and again, when H is non-zero, it may or may not be wholly fair. But the real derivation is really in the spirit of Beasley and Witten's analysis of 4-dimensional QCD, and also supersymmetric QCD, and also some work of Seiberg and some collaborators from last year. And I must confess, the idea for the analysis that we're actually pursue, I must attribute to my collaborator, Alarian. It's a wonderful idea, and he was the one who pointed out we ought to do this. So this is going to be a computation on the world sheet in 0,2 supersymmetry. Let me briefly review some of the conventions. Here's my superspace. I have Z and Z bar, which are ordinary holomorphic and anti-holomorphic coordinates on a world sheet. And then theta and theta bar are going to be my anti-commuting coordinates for a 0,2 superspace. I have supersymmetry charges, associated D's, obeying standard commutation relations. In 0,2 supersymmetry, I have chiral and Fermi superfields. So in 2-dimensional 2,2 supersymmetry, I have a 2,2 chiral superfield consisting of a boson, a right-moving fermion, a left-moving fermion, and an auxiliary field. In 0,2, those 4 objects get broken up between what are called 0,2 chiral superfields and 0,2 Fermi superfields. The 0,2 chiral superfields contain a boson and the right-moving fermion. The Fermi superfields contain a left-moving fermion and an auxiliary field, and they're constrained to obey, you know, these sorts of conditions like good chiral operators. A 0,2 Lagrangian, this particular form goes back to Dine and Seiberg from about a quarter century ago now. In a 2,2 symmetric theory, I could write the Lagrangian in terms of some integral over superspace of a Kähler potential. Here in this 0,2 theory, I no longer have a Kähler potential. Instead, I have some sort of Kähler one form. I have a one form that plays the same role as the potential does in 2,2 cases. In particular, I have that because in general, the metric won't be Kähler in a 0,2 case. So I have some derivation of why that particular form is the most general one you can expect. At leading order in alpha prime, where H is closed, then the Hermitian form associated with the metric has this property. which I can write in components. Thus, which is an integrability condition, it means that derivative of the metric can be written as a different derivative of something else, which can itself be written as derivative of a holomorphic one-form, or anti-holomorphic one-form in this case, and combining with complex conjugates, I get the expression for the metric, an expression for the metric in terms of derivatives of one-forms rather than functions. So putting this together, if I expand that out in superspace, here's the action in components. I have kinetic terms for bosons, a B-field term, kinetic terms for fermions. This omega includes both the Levi-Civita connection on the target space as well as the torsion. Here are the left-moving fermions coupling to the left-moving non-abelian gauge field on the target space. And here is the four Fermi term. In this language, a supersymmetric marginal operator should be of the following form, an integral over half of superspace of a chiral superfield. There's a small theorem embedded in here, which was really worked out in the 2-2 case by Green, Seiberg, Komargodsky, Tachikawa, and Wecht last May. And the 0-2 analog of it, which is a trivial modification, has been worked out in unpublished work by Ido Adem, my collaborator, and Ronan Plesser. So all supersymmetric marginal operators have to be of this form. There's a quick check that that actually is consistent. The most general possible supersymmetric marginal operator I could add to the action, consistent with classical dimensions and all symmetries, has this form. These capital gammas are the Fermi superfields associated with left-moving fermions. The phis are 0-2 chiral superfields containing the maps into the target space. And here is the lambda, y, and z I discussed earlier. These are just functions with indices. That's about all they are at the level of this particular gadget. So in particular, this defines the z, the y, and the lambda that appeared in the proposal I wrote down earlier. Now, I can't just work with any z, y, and lambda. In order for this to really to define a marginal operator, I need for this operator x to be a chiral superfield. So I need to impose the condition that x be annihilated by d bar on shell. So I get to use the equations of motion, and after quite a bit of algebra, that reduces to these conditions. So these conditions are derived as a statement that from adding the most general possible supersymmetric marginal operator to the 0-2 theory. These are just the conditions for worldsheet supersymmetry, in essence. Now, not all possible cocycles, not all solutions to those equations will correspond to distinct infinitesimal moduli. I get to mod out by equivalences, and this could be a little bit subtle. For example, in a superconformal field theory, two marginal operators that differ by a superspace derivative can change the action but still define the same deformation. For example, in a 2-2 supersymmetric theory, I can change the Kähler form by an exact form without deforming the superconformal field theory. In this case, if I have two marginal operators that differ by a d bar of some superfield, then they define the same superconformal deformation. And I'll omit those details since I'm already a couple minutes over. The dimensions and symmetries here require that if I take that chiral superfield from earlier that defined the marginal deformations of that two-dimensional superconformal field theory, I can add to a d bar of any superfield. Dimensions and symmetries would require that this superfield be some combination of this form for some little lambda, some mu, and some zeta. And when I expand that out in components, I get these shifts. There's another source of co-boundaries. I can add to this chiral superfield the partial derivative of any other chiral superfield. Dimensional analysis and symmetries imply that that other chiral superfield, if I'm really taking the x corresponding to marginal operators, from dimensional analysis and symmetries, y has to be of this form for some xi. And when you combine that with the previous co-boundaries and do a lot of algebra, this is the cleanest expression we can get for the resulting possible co-boundaries. Let's see, I'm about 5 minutes over. Briefly, so far I've talked about moduli. Since the moduli are modified, you might well ask, what about the charged matter? in a heterodicobolabial compactification, the charged matter are counted by some other math groups. You might ask whether those are modified. However, we think there aren't. There is a PDE you could write down, which in principle would describe a deformation, a linkage between those guys, but the different groups correspond to different representations of the low energy gauge group, and that's, you know, briefly, that's incompatible with any sort of mixing between these mathematical guys. So we believe there's no modification to the charged matter spectrum, only to the singlet matter. All right, to summarize, I started this talk by outlining what's known about moduli and heterotic string compactifications, and raised two issues. First, what are the moduli in non-Kähler case, where we really haven't had any clue at all? And then secondly, there have been these recent results of Laura Anderson, James Gray, Andre Lucas, and Bert Overit, which give a more subtle understanding of Kähler cases. Their analysis took place wholly on the target space. In fact, we got into this asking how to understand their results from a worldsheet perspective. I presented a proposal for the infinitesimal moduli of all these cases, which gives a worldsheet understanding of Lara and company's target space results, as well as encodes a proposal for non-Kähler cases. And then I've very briefly here at the end outlined where the devil this came from. And again, the idea was we take some two-dimensional theory, we just figure out the most general possible supersymmetric marginal operator you can write, add to the theory, the supersymmetry conditions, everything else follows from supersymmetry. The proposal itself, those moduli, are really just the conditions for that marginal operator to be compatible with supersymmetry. Right, and that's it. Well, they are describing they're describing infinitesimal shifts. I might imagine, for example, that there could be potential terms. Let me talk about just Kähler compactification so I don't worry about any of the potential headaches associated with non-Kähler cases. In the Kähler case, I'll get some four-dimensional n equals one supersymmetric theory with a bunch of massless fields, massless neutral fields, counted by, well, the cocycles, mod co-boundaries I presented here. Now, in addition to having those massless fields, it might be the case that there are some potential terms. And some of those potential terms might lift some of those directions. For example, if I have massless phi to the 4 theory, then the potential lifts, even though the phi field is massless, the potential lifts the field. And so that's what I mean by infinitesimal moduli. A non-infinitesimal modulus would be a modulus that's not obstructed by any sort of potential term in the low energy theory, or mathematically a modulus that's not obstructed by some higher order mathematical obstruction in the sense of obstruction theory.
Yes, that's what I was asking. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that, you said physically there could be potential terms, mm-hmm. but mathematically you said there could be other obstructions.
It's obstructions.
Are
it's exactly obstructions.
Yeah. Is it the same?
Yeah, it's the same. Well, you know, I guess for this new stuff, no one's had the time yet to really straighten out the details, but certainly for the old story, for the original, let's say, 2-2 supersymmetric story and compactifications and compactifications to four-dimensional n equals one supersymmetric theories, there was a lot of work done 20 years ago in which people checked that the potential terms you get correspond nicely to possible obstructions. So for example, there's a lovely old paper by Witten called New Issues and Manifolds of SU3 Holonomy, which does a number of things, but in particular, for example, discusses how the mathematical obstructions to bundle moduli, the higher order obstructions to bundle moduli counted by elements of higher degree sheaf cohomology classes valued in the endomorphisms, how those appear physically as potential terms in the low energy theory for the massless scalars corresponding to certain bundle deformations. So it's, you know, for the new stuff, no one's checked whether that story still holds, but for the, you know, older material, that was all worked out and checked in detail 20 years ago, so I would be simply floored if the same thing were not also true here.
Okay. Right. You said these equations for the moduli or a proposal. Mm-hmm. You had a derivation from the worksheet theory. Can you repeat what are the caveats?
It's only a proposal rather than just a fact. I guess the one I'm advertising this as, the really exciting thing is the possibility that these are the moduli in non-Kähler cases. The worry in the back of my mind is that our derivation was a purely worldsheet derivation. and purely worldsheet derivations usually implicitly rely on the existence of a large radius limit. Purely worldsheet derivations are perfectly safe so long as you can go to a large radius limit, do the computation there, and then sort of perturb around. In non-Kähler cases, I can't go to a large radius limit. I can perturb around, but the perturbation, but I don't have any control over the perturbations, over the effect those will have on things.
Yeah, so the worldsheet derivation may miss alpha prime corrections.
It will miss alpha prime corrections, and some of those alpha prime corrections might conceivably mess things up. So any, more to the point, any discussion of any relation of modulo Lilia's comments from earlier, any discussion of non-Kähler compactifications and geometry is somewhat formal. So I'm always being a somewhat cautious individual. Whenever I talk about non-Kähler compactifications and geometry, I throw my hands up and say it's formal, there can be alpha prime corrections, I have no control over them. So in a worst case scenario, we could have a beautiful picture for non-Kähler cases that can never be realized in practice, would be the worst possible version of this. But to the extent one can apply geometry to non-Kähler cases, I think this worldsheet derivation is basically the best one can hope to do. So the reason I'm calling it a proposal, not a derivation, is just because since I can't go to large radius, I can't really physically rigorously argue that this must be the answer. Instead, I'm saying that there may be corrections, it might not be the right answer, but to the extent that we can latch geometry onto non-Kähler compactification, if this is as close as anyone knows how to get right now.
But it was not just alpha prime corrections. You really set alpha prime to zero. So if you don't, and you deal with dH equals stuff, what would you do then?
Well, I don't know what to do. If alpha prime is really non-zero, then and it is in non-Kähler compactifications, then the honest answer is I really don't think I know how to work at finite non-zero alpha prime, or the way we usually work. The way the story usually works in string compactifications is we go to alpha prime equals zero, we go to a large radius limit, we do our math physics dictionary there, and then we perturb away from the large radius limit. And what can happen as you move away from the large radius limit is that, for example, physically, states can pair up and become massive. So I could have some things that are massless at large radius that as I move away from a large radius might pair up, gain a mass, and so disappear from the massless spectrum. In particular, it's possible to write down families of conformal field theories. Well, we really write them down as families of massive theories and flow them to the infrared, and then compute massless spectra at either end of the family. And what you find in such cases is that typically the massless spectra at either end of the family are very similar to one another, but not exactly the same, because in the process of continuously walking down the conformal field theory moduli space from one end to the other, some states that are massless at one end will become massless and pair up and become massive and disappear from the massless spectrum. Ditto for states starting from the opposite end and moving forward. Now, in this case, the reason I'm reasonably optimistic here is that is more or less Lilia's reasoning. We would like to believe, in order to apply geometry to non-Kähler compactifications at all, we would like to believe that there exist non-Kähler compactifications in which alpha prime is large, such that the radius is large, such that alpha prime is close to zero, such that alpha prime is small. And then in those cases, I don't know systematically how to do perturbation theory around non-zero alpha prime. I can formally pretend alpha prime is equal to zero, get some result there, and then the correct result will be some perturbation of that. I don't know how to compute the perturbations right now, but so long as those perturbations are small, then the completely formal result when alpha prime is equal to zero may nevertheless be a very good guide to what the answer will be when alpha prime is small but non-zero. Make sense? And that's really the best that I think anyone working on non-Kähler compactifications can manage to do.
What is strange from the point of view of physics, uh-huh, that you choose your size. It's mm-hmm. not like in ordinary compactor, it's dynamical, you know, like it's a dynamical process. Here you just say, oh, let's choose it to be large.
Well, the reason is that...
Let's choose it even larger, then how would they compare this to? It's just...
The reason is that in a Clavial compactification, we have this breathing mode. So in a Clavial compactification, we have a globally flat modulus in which I can just go out to large radius and play around there and then smoothly deform the theory back and forth. And so where I am, you know, how big I am, how small alpha prime is just determined by the VEV of some scalar field which is unobstructed by potential terms. So I can just adjust it to be anything I want and compute the theory there and even play games with continuously varying that parameter between limits. With non-Kähler compactifications, I don't have that freedom. That modulus is just removed. Feel free.
This is again the point that I was always thinking. It's just saying that the right moduli are not those that we told before, Kähler complex and bundle.
Fine.
But the right moduli will be some combinations of them. So here you cannot rescale just the breathing mode, but maybe the new rescale thing, the new redefined combination could be rescaled. We just don't know what it is yet.
I am asking even something. Naive questions than before. Like, it's not about moduli. I'm just saying, suppose I give you this size of manifold or that size, and to me they're completely different models. So are you saying there are like infinitely many models, and there is some arbitrary parameter which is your size? And
in a Clavial compactification, that's exactly it. You have an arbitrary parameter which is exactly the size, and you can.
There you have a potential. You work hard to make a potential, you stabilize it, and this is your fixed point, and you're done. That's physical, dynamical situation. Here,
in a traditional
arbitrariness.
In a traditional heterotic Clavial compactification, we don't stabilize the moduli. In fact, this is why they're unphysical. We have these massless scalar fields, which cannot possibly have any physical content, and so a traditional heterotic Clavial compactification cannot literally describe the real world. And indeed, that's why people have to work so hard to, you know, add fluxes or type 2 compactifications, add brains, add orientifolds, add all kinds of stuff.
Right, that's
so
right.
As to remove all those directions.
But at least it gives you physical mechanism, no? You know that this choice of size is something which you determine dynamically.
So here there will be some discrete infinity, but that's like to say discrete infinity of fluxes. Here too there will be some potential when taking into account various corrections. And some point among that discrete infinity will be somehow most compatible with minimal potential. Just like when you stabilize moduli in type 2 or something and you have various fluxes. It's similar.
Why it's discrete? It seems to me real. Like, size is a real number. You really have for each choice of real number, you have a different model and you suggest to analyze whatever.
The two of you might be, I think, confusing Clavial and non-Kähler cases. I think Lily was probably referring to the non-Kähler case, and you were probably referring to the Clavial cases. I think that's the.
I'm talking about non-Kähler case because for Kähler, I'm happy. I know what to do for Kähler case.
Fair enough.
I'm
fair enough.
I'm confused about non-Kähler case.
Fair enough.
Everybody's confused.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
You said that you would love to reformulate this in terms of target space.
I'd love to have a target space derivation. So I presented a derivation at the very end and very briefly. So I apologize. So it may not have been wholly clear, but I somewhere in there I presented a derivation purely on the world sheet, just in terms of let's count the possible supersymmetric marginal operators you can add to the theory. And there's lots of algebra which I glossed over because you guys didn't really want to see it, I'm sure. But the result was you got, you know, this expression for infinitesimal for Kerr cycles and co-boundaries. Now, It would be neat to get an analogous derivation just from the target space theory. There's certainly been some work in that direction, and at least some, you know, and some results. There's some work of I guess Melanie Becker, Li Sheng Tseng, and Xingtong Yao about a year ago, 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, in which they in which they basically derived second order equations. So one approach to this, you might ask, is can we derive an analog of the Lichnerowitz equation? For Clavials, we can derive a Lichnerowitz equation just from imposing Ricci flatness on possible metric deformations, which gives us, when you interpret the results, some statement that the complex and Kähler moduli are, you know, are harmonic representatives of cohomology classes. You could ask, is there some analog of that sort of computation you can do in non-Kähler cases? Can you derive a set of second-order equations? And indeed, Melanie, Li Sheng, and Xingtong Yao derived a set of second-order equations for moduli in non-Kähler compactifications. The results are truthfully a bit messy. And to be able to interpret them as cohomology classes, you'd have to already have some understanding of what the cohomology theory is, because you need to be able to figure out what the relevant Laplacian is. You need to figure out what the analog of the exterior derivative is, so that you can compute its dual, compute the Laplacian, and then recognize that second order PDE is really telling you that the Laplacian is annihilating something. They came up with some second order differential equations. They weren't able to write down a Laplacian or interpret it as some sort of cohomology theory, basically because without knowing the answer in advance, it's more or less impossible. Just given a random second order PDE, it's essentially impossible to guess what cohomology theory it's coming from. So they do have some second order PDEs that they've written down. They weren't, to my knowledge, able to interpret it as any sort of cohomology theory, which makes it essentially impossible to compute anything. That said, it would be really neat. So they have a derivation of second order PDEs. It would be really neat if you could derive these first order PDEs, derive these co-cycle conditions and co-boundaries from some sort of target space computation. I don't know what it would be in general, but if you could, it would be deeply satisfying.
What did they derive this from? The second order
PDE? Oh, from the equations of motion of the theory, in essence. They started with
the supergravity equation.
That's exactly it. They started with the supergravity equation of motion, deform the metric, deform the bundle, and derive some second order PDEs from that. Yeah.
So sorry, this is probably a little bit off.
That's all right.
I mean, many years ago, some people using some very almost crude arguments of mirror symmetry, extending mm-hmm. mirror symmetry to some regimes where you don't really have Calabi-Yau, you have deformations of Calabi-Yau, mm-hmm. and they found these kind of generalized SU3 manifolds, and they are somehow kind of related to the original Calabi-Yau that you started from. Mm-hmm. In some sense, they're deformation of those things. Mm-hmm. Does that somehow fit into this picture?
I'd love to know. In fact, that was one of the questions I asked. There was a slide somewhere in the middle. If you're curious, feel free to send me an email. I'll send you the PDF of this talk. Okay. There's a slide somewhere in the middle with a list of questions about that proposal. How can you do this? How can you? That was one of the questions. Is there any relationship to, for example, Hitchin's generalized complex geometry? When Hitchin talks about generalized complex geometry, everything's built in terms of actions on Tx plus the cotangent bundle. Here we have a tangent plus cotangent bundle, or rather an extension of the tangent bundle by the cotangent bundle. Could it be, for example, that the eigenbundle of the generalized almost complex structure matrix, when acting on the complexification of Tx plus T star x, could it be that that eigenbundle is actually this particular extension? That would be really neat. I have no idea. One can imagine possible relations that might exist. I'm very curious about whether any of these would hold. I simply don't know. It's an excellent question. Other questions? All right.